What is Demystifying Research? Hosted by me, Kelly Harris.
And me, Catherine Hoyt.
Demystifying Research is a space where we dialogue on training, careers, and all things research.
Everything from is research right for me to thinking about applications, mentorship, which research degree is right for me, handling failure and rejection, CVs versus resumes, and funding. This is a space where we engage in discussions around the questions we all have or have had when considering a career in research and science.
As clinician scientists, we seek to answer questions and address issues that aren't clearly addressed in more formal spaces, things that weren't addressed in our clinical training, questions that we may not know how or where to begin to seek answers. This is not a space only for scientists and researchers, but for anyone who may be interested in science and research. We're so glad you've joined us. Let's dive in.
Could you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you're doing now?
Yeah. So, and Kelly, we don't know each other, so I'll maybe speak a little. No, this is good because I can speak to you a little more because Catherine knows like every intricate, intimate detail probably. So I am an occupational therapist by trade, and I've basically dedicated my career to stroke research and with a focus on helping individuals with stroke to live better lives, be healthier, have a better quality of life, do the things they want or need to do, more equitable quality of life and access to healthcare and being healthy, all of that. So with that, right now I'm at Ohio State University, assistant professor on the tenure track. I teach a little bit evidence-based practice course, but mostly I do research and I'm new here. I've been here not quite 6 months, so I'm really working on developing my connections here in Columbus because I was in Cincinnati, and I have some research that I'm doing there too, and will continue. But yeah, so I'm here, and the goal is to get as much funding from wherever I can to address kind of like the public health needs of people with stroke, and then eventually, you know, any neurological condition, but it's all about chronic management. And so that's where I am right now. I'm also like getting into stroke specialty clinics and primary care work. But my kind of forte was a community-based stroke intervention. So I'll go way back, long, long time ago. I was at OT on a rehab unit. I wanted to learn, be able to do more research, evidence-based practices. I was a little limited to where I was. So I started working in a stroke research lab, actually at University of Cincinnati. And it was incredible because I really got to work with people who were living in the community. So I got to see, like, when they left rehab, I got to see what life was really like, and I hadn't seen that before. So that's when I realized, oh goodness, like, oh, these people need so much more help, and our country and healthcare system is just completely failing them, especially if they're marginalized in any manner, like anything at all, being a woman, different races and ethnicities, you know, education level, socioeconomic status, maybe just the neighborhood you're living in. Like, it's just insane. So long story short, that's when, this is my OT degree, is a bachelor's degree. And I got my master's in health science education kind of at the same time because I knew I wanted to teach somehow. I just didn't know exactly how. So while I was working in this lab, I decided, I knew I wanted to get a doctorate. And I decided I was going to get a PhD because my goal is to get an NIH grant one day to actually develop a community-based intervention to help stroke survivors. I was in like 2008, and people, researchers, scientists I work with scoffed at me like, haha, you're never gonna, like, that's just not how this works. But I was like, well, I'm gonna try. So I got my PhD and in health and rehab sciences. Should I share where I went? I guess I'll just share where I went to school. I have all of my degrees from Indiana University, And most of my schooling was on the Indianapolis campus, so formerly known as IUPUI, now it's IUI. And I had really great mentorship there, which is why I went back and did my PhD there. There were lots of other places I looked at, different opportunities. My mentor there is just, he's incredible. He's like my OT dad still to this day. And he's really helped advocate for me across my entire career. And it was a great program. And I had a lot of flexibility with going to that program. I could use my lab experience where I was working, to like further my true interest. So I did that. And then I went to University of Southern California and did a T32 postdoc, learning about clinical trial phases and rehabilitation. I did a strip fellowship out there too. And then I got an NIH grant because I had such an incredible opportunity there. My mentors were incredible. Everything just kind of lined up during the postdoc. So then I got the NIH K99-ROO early career investigator postdoc to like ROO, at which time then I did the K99 piece in Los Angeles in Los Angeles County Health Systems at Rancho Los Amigos National Rehab Center, which again was like the maybe the most incredible experience career-wise I've ever had in my life. And then I thought I want to go back to Cincinnati to see if I can, bring back this type of intervention because I developed community-based intervention out there. So I came back to the University of Cincinnati because they just started their OT program. And when I had been there before at the research lab, they didn't have an OT program. And I was very invested in this. So I came back and did that, did the efficacy study. It was pretty challenging to do because it's very different in Cincinnati than Los Angeles for all the reasons you can imagine. The COVID happened. And then I needed to make another change to really focus on my research. So that's how I am now at Ohio State University. So that's my life in a nutshell. I've been married and divorced, had some boyfriends. I had some cats. Now I have a dog. There you go.
No, that's great. And I think rolls right into what would be my next question, which is, so you talked a little bit about getting the T32, which is a funding mechanism for that postdoc piece, but how did you fund your PhD? You want to talk about funding mechanisms and if you're willing to say what you did and then what other things you might know about.
Yeah, you called it adventurous. I want to hear all about how you funded it.
Well, I say adventurous, but it didn't feel great at the time, but I'm making it through. I'm still paying my PhD. So I made notes that I was like, okay, what were the options and why did I do what I did? But I guess I'll share some of the options that we know about and then why I chose what I chose. But, there are PhDs that there's a stipend that you get to live, and then they also cover all of your PhD training, the cost of courses and conferences and whatever else that you do, usually with your advisor. If they have research funding, then you probably have even more opportunities that are covered. So that's one option. And then there are PhDs that partially support some of that. Maybe they pay for housing, but you don't get a stipend. PhDs, and when I was looking at my experience, cost a bit more than a doctorate, separate from a clinical doctorate. So like an advanced degree, a doctorate of health sciences, for example, something I was looking into, honestly, because it was cheaper and quicker. And I could have maybe gotten a few scholarships or something. So there are always scholarships and things that you can apply for out there. You can also apply for funding through agencies. I think actually I'm speaking out of my knowledge base right now. Like maybe NIH has some different funding things for like pre-doctoral. I can't really speak to that because I didn't do it, but I know there are other options out there. And I did look when I was applying, but I couldn't find any federal type funding that I could apply for the degree that I went for at IUPUI. I think, so for me, I was working, well, I guess I should say, when you're looking for a PhD, you really need to consider your entire life situation. And, you know, are you coming straight out of a clinical doctorate degree and going into a PhD? Because that's a whole different experience than me. I finished my master's. I was already practicing as an OT. In order to start this PhD at IU, I had to wait 2 years. You had to have 2 years of clinical experience at most of the places that I was looking into because of I wanted like a health and or rehab science type of PhD. I knew I had to wait 2 years, but then actually since I did my PhD at IUPUI, they had just started their PhD program for the first time. Like I was in the charter class. So I had to wait a little bit longer. So I was like 3-ish years out from graduating from my master's degree. I worked in the research lab full time. I was like treating occupational therapists, did some other research. I was doing a lot of presenting at every different conference that you can imagine. So I was getting a lot of great experience. I was training other occupational and physical therapists how to do the interventions that we were testing in our lab. They were evidence-based. We were just testing like intensity, like different components. So I was doing that. And the idea of not working, like quitting doing that just wasn't an option. Like I really wanted to stay working in a lab, doing that work. It was like the best I've ever felt in my career was right before my PhD. And I loved my work. I loved life. Everything was great. I was married at the time too. So at IUPUI, like I said, they didn't have any funding. It was brand new PhD. And so I decided, okay, well, I really want to go there. I have an incredible support system, quite a few stroke researchers and advisors who all knew each other. So for me, that was really important. So I decided, okay, I'm going to do that. I had to pay out of state tuition for 1 or 2 years, but I moved to Indiana during it to be in state. So I bought a house. So I said before I was married at the time. And so we sat down and made a plan like, okay, yeah, Valerie, you could do this. We can do this. I was working PRN. So I was working a full-time job and I did PRN in the beginning to pay what I could. Then life like exploded and long story short, I was getting divorced and, my ex had lost the job that he had, which contributed enough. So then there I was like single, one income, totally trying to take care of a new house and working full time and still doing PRN. And so I just did student loans from then on out, which I'm still paying. But for me, it was just the only reasonable way to be able to continue doing my PhD without needing to make another huge life change, like downsizing. And even then I think, you know, it was hard time. So the actual deciding to do the PhD, I mean, I did think long and hard. I thought I was going to go to another local university for their doctorate of health sciences. I sent a Christmas letter out because we used to do that every year. And one of the people I sent it to is my OT dad. And he got my letter and I put in there, like, this is what we're doing. And he called me immediately and he was like, how did you make this decision without talking to me more? And I was like, well, it just makes sense. I can do it quickly. I can get out. And he was like, what's your number one goal in your career? And I was like, I really want to get an NIH grant so that I can actually develop an intervention and like have a funded lab to study this with people with stroke. And he was like, well, you're not going to be able to do that with a DHS. So if you're really serious about your life career plan, you really need to get a PhD. And so I was like, okay. So that's when I was like, okay, I'm definitely going to get the PhD. And he wasn't convincing me because there was a PhD where he was working. It really was just made the most sense. So I did plan with my ex, and you know, there was a whole plan and everything, but the plan did not work out, which happens. And you know,
so many plans go astray.
Yeah, I know so many people, and I think I'm totally off track right now, but I know so many.
Well, I just want to say, I think you brought up a couple key things in terms of like talking to people.
Yeah,
right?
Like to figure absolutely out important
and help make those decisions. One of the things I heard, and then I heard you kind of saying like how you laid out the options, right? And so some PhD programs are fully funded, others are not. It's certainly a consideration. And like at some of the, you know, kind of federal funding that I know about is like, are, you know, post acceptance into a program and coursework complete, and then you can apply for like funding to complete your dissertation or something like that.
Yeah. But, the university or federal.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think those require like this conversation with a mentor, with somebody who's, you know, committed to your success, which is the other thing that I really hear you describing and what you've shared. So definitely, it does sound adventurous for sure, right?
I will say, you know, I didn't even realize, and I talked to a few different people within my network, you know, I was still early in my career, and there were lots of changes. Like my OT program was a bachelor's degree. So we didn't talk a lot about what's next. What's next was that you go and you work as an OT. And even in my master's program, it was in education. And so we talked a lot about now teaching health or rehab science type stuff, not going and applying for NIH funding. And so I knew what my aspirations felt like. I didn't know how I was going to get there. And so, yeah, finding an advisor, someone who sees your potential, that for me was absolutely essential. And I'm first generation college student in my family. And so nobody in my family really knew, right? My mom would Google stuff and then be like, well, hey, like this is available. And I would talk to other colleagues and, you know, OT friends, whatever, but I didn't even realize that you could have a fully funded PhD experience, like fully funded stipend, all of that, because none of the places I looked offered that. So I didn't even know. And I didn't look, you know, I was looking at schools that were kind of in the same ranking as IU, which is great ranking, but there are more opportunities. Now it might be different, but back then, I feel like there are more opportunities out there that I just didn't even tap into because I didn't even think about it. And, you know, I have all these friends who went to WashU and have had these really incredible experiences, who've had many things funded. I don't know it all. And I admire them. But I also wouldn't have changed my experience at all because I absolutely loved the program that I was in.
That's an important point, though, that it's not clear. I'm working with a trainee now who's considering pursuing a PhD and looking at all the programs. It's not very clear, even when you go to a program's website necessarily, like what they fund or what they don't fund, like what's going on there. It seems like it's still a little bit of, you have to know what to ask.
You do.
Yeah. I think you definitely have to know what to ask. And I think even like one of the things I learned is just kind of being very open about your interests. So my PhD dissertation But my interest also aligned with a fellowship in American culture studies that I didn't know existed until I was having a conversation with someone. And that funded 1 year of my PhD work, which, I needed that fifth year. So that's have it. Yeah. So I think it's, I don't know, that's the theme I'm drawing out of this is like we really have to talk it, to folks around you when you're applying, asking the questions, what money is available and where. And then just talking about what you're interested in, because I think people, it triggers like, oh, well, this thing exists over here, which might be related to what you're interested in, which might not be, an
Like,
easy
thank
assessment.
goodness for that other OT mentor. Sorry, Kelly. I was just thinking, like, what you were saying. And Val, you mentioned that it was just kind of through happenstance sharing that letter, like, this is what you want to be doing, and having somebody say, like, oh, this isn't the degree path for you.
Totally. I would have gone into that other program and probably quit to go into IU's program. But who knows? I think if I would have done that other path, I didn't share what school, so life would have been so much easier. And I know a lot of people who did the program, and but I would not have gotten the. Definitely wouldn't have had the experience that I had that I needed in order to be where I am now. And yeah, that
You've
mentor.
gotten NIH funding. I feel like life goal
I know.
achieved.
Yeah, no, it was. It was like once I went to the postdoc, like I've really liked my life and my career for the most part to this point. So I'm just raw and open. And the postdoc, it was such an incredible experience, but wow, how it changes, how it can change you, and morph you, stretch you. And then, my ultimate, I never thought I would actually get an NIH grant, but that was always my goal. And I was, but I will tell you that same mentor that told me I need to get my PhD also shared the postdoc at University of Southern California with me twice. The first year, because I was out of that lab I'd been working in, and I was working at local university, and I really liked that, but it was hard to do that and do my dissertation. Like it was just hard, but I did it. And I was looking for jobs because I was just on a temporary clinical faculty line there. So I was looking for jobs, and I just wasn't competitive to do what I wanted to do and the resources I knew I would need. But then the places like where I was working at the time, and then other places similar, private university not associated with the med center, they couldn't offer me minimal resources that I would have needed, like lab space, and allow me to collaborate in big ways in different places. So that's when I went back to my OT mentor, and I was like, hey, so here are all the places I'm interviewing or have interviewed, and I'm still stuck. And he was like, have you reconsidered the postdoc? Because we thought I didn't need a postdoc because I had worked in a lab for like 7 years. But I did need it to do what I wanted to do. So I ended up applying, and I again never thought I would be accepted, and I was. So if it wasn't for him, I mean, I would have taken a no, this is no offense to anyone else. But for me personally, if I would have gone like a softer road, it would have been easier, but I would have never been able, and I just know I would have never been able to do what I've done now or had the opportunity. And I wouldn't be as competitive when I'm looking for jobs or grants or, anything. So.
Those mentors and sponsors are so important in this
Yeah,
career path.
I think reaching, yeah, being comfortable reaching out. And I think all of, advisees or students that we have, like in our OT scientist kind of world, they're pretty connected, but there's so many others out there that just are not connected and have no idea how to get connected.
I think there's so many variables in like who people can get connected with and how, and whether you've had exposure to doing that before. So I just wanted to go back a little bit because you had mentioned, as you were talking about like your experience going through your PhD, and we've talked about how there's some that are funded and some that are partially and some that are not. Did you totally self-fund yourself getting through your PhD?
Just yeah, want to be very I'm clear. I'm yes, 100%, and I'm totally still paying that self-funded PhD.
Yeah. How long did it take you to get to like from start to finish, like defend your thesis?
It took just under 5 years, but I did take about one solid semester break because I totally burnt out. I got divorced and burnt out like physically and emotionally. And so my committee let me like tend to some health stuff and then also regroup. And I had some other hangups with access to my data and some other things that I had no control over. If those things wouldn't have happened, I was like shooting to finish a little early, but you know, 5 years was perfectly reasonable and fine. Mm-hmm. And yeah, but I had to pay for a fifth year, but you know,
yeah,
at that point, it doesn't matter.
So I think there's like so many programs that you do pay to go through the PhD training. Mm-hmm. Do you know of any, you know, we talked a little bit about that, like there's kind of potentially ways to get funded through your lab or like maybe other grants or scholarships. Are you aware of any that you would want people to know about?
Ugh. You guys probably know more. I personally think when you're looking for a PhD, it's absolutely reasonable to contact the PhD director where you're interested in applying and ask them, go on their website and look at who has funded research, what research labs are there, and ask, you know, does anyone have funding to cover me? Because I know, at least from my work, I can help cover, I can fund, or could have funded a PhD student on my grant. But I never thought to ask something like that before. And yeah, I never thought to ask, but there probably could have been funding available. So I think asking scientists who have labs or just asking the PhD director, because that could make or break your opportunity. And they might not be thinking about it. You know, they might not. There are so many students who apply and reach out interested in PhD programs that as someone who's a professor and assistant professor in a PhD program, like if a student submits something and they share what they're interested in and it's like in alignment with faculty, that's perfect. That's an obvious. But maybe the PhD student doesn't know exactly what they want to do. I think doing that research and asking, that's a way that I know that you can get funding. Also going to the university and looking at what grants and resources they have available. And I know for me, I might've, now I understand the system, I might've qualified for some scholarships, but when I would read the descriptions, I'm like, oh, I don't qualify. But probably I did now looking in hindsight. So I think that's a really big deal because it, especially at the graduate level, PhD level, there's often funding, maybe not in the program you're applying to, but at the university grad school. And it's worth applying. Apply to everything. Sometimes they have money and people don't apply, so they just have the money. So apply to things, apply to all the things. You just never know what you might get. I'm seriously,
I feel like it's a good takeaway,
right? If you don't apply, it's an automatic no.
Yeah.
And you could even apply to something that like, hey, you're not eligible for this, but there is this other thing.
Yeah.
You know, I can direct you. So I love that. Yeah, definitely apply. Don't count yourself out, right?
Right. So
let other people count you out.
Right.
Yeah.
Never. You just put yourself out there and try to make the match as good as you can. It's not up to you to decide if you qualify or not. It's up to the people reviewing.
You can also email and ask. Is like something that I didn't think about when I was younger. Like you could email whoever is in charge of an award or a scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Be like, here's who I am.
Or even just the grad school. Contact the grad school, student affairs. People working in student affairs, that they've committed their life to helping students get into school and graduate from school successfully. And however, and I mean, if you really, really are in need of funds, there, I think there are a lot of opportunities out there. And I don't know how this is going to continue with kind of the culture of our nation right now, but I also think if there's anything that makes it harder for you to pay for your schooling or to have like to live while you're in school, it's worth asking if there's any funds, like a need-based fund, or like I never thought to ask for funding because I was a first generation student. And I don't know if there was funding back when I was in my PhD, but now there is. And I would have never thought of that. So,
what about loan repayment? Sorry, go ahead, Kelly.
No, I was going to ask, you know, now that you're in this repayment phase, what are those options?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'll say I deferred my PhD payments. Like I've been making small payments, but I deferred as much as I could. So through my PhD, I was paying in the beginning, but then when I had that crisis, I was like, okay, like I just need to do everything else as easily as I can. And so I deferred, and then I did a postdoc, and then I did another postdoc. And so I deferred for the most part through my postdoc. But then, you know, when I took my first faculty position, my quote unquote big girl job, that's when I was like, okay, now I really, cause I didn't really attend to them much. I just put them on the back burner and pursued my career. Like I kept thinking about them, but then I kept taking these risks, right? So I would think about it, take the risk. And during the risk, I had to put on the back burner. And then I took another risk, another opportunity, kept them on the back burner. Probably not the most responsible approach, but that's what I did. And then 2018 is when I was done with my postdocs and started my faculty position. Since between then and now, I qualified for a loan forgiveness at one point. I think it was during COVID because there were different opportunities. And honestly, I had just been deferring and I didn't have anybody like helping me consult or anything, but then I learned about a consultant. I do not even know how I learned about them. But it's a consultant through Fed Loans and now Mohila. So they consolidated all of my loans. Cause you know, I had like 13 through all of the semesters that I was at IUPUI. So they consolidated all of those for me. And then I started making just, you know, like the one payment to them. And they're the ones who applied for the forgiveness for me. I don't qualify for the public health forgiveness because I deferred so long. But I will when, like in a few years. And I do think that people who work in health sciences, medicine, who have dedicated their career to research really should apply for that. It's not like welfare, you know, something. It really is. We could make a lot more money if we did something else, but we chose to do this public health work. And the funding is coming intentionally to help those of us who have done the work. And, you know, if you really need it, you really should. But the thing that I'm working on right now is an NIH loan repayment plan. I don't know if I will get repayment yet, but I will say that I made it through the first two rounds. So that just means upon submission, I had everything there that needed to be there. Then it was reviewed. And again, they confirmed I had everything that needed to be there the way that it needed to be there. And now I have been referred or assigned to an institute. And it was the institute that I had requested, which is National Institutes of Minority Health and Health Disparities, because that's who I was funded by before. And that's the work that I do, health disparities. But then I also have the Neuro Institute, like, on the back burner. So I don't know yet if I'm going to get that or not. I've tried to submit two other times, but for various reasons, wasn't able to get the application 100% where it needed to be by the date. And those are reasons out of my control.
That's another one, though, that even if you don't get it on the first time, you reapply and reapply.
Yes. Yeah. But you have to actually apply, and like just getting it in. So I'll say with mine, I didn't think I was going to submit, but then I was like, oh, actually I can. So I needed to ask last minute for help from a friend to send a letter, like legitimate reference. And the institute, their letter was like a day late, and the institute still took it, and they messaged me, and they were like, we see that you have everything you need here. You just need to hit submit. Can you do that in the next few days? We'll still process your request. So I feel very lucky. That do not expect that to happen ever. But I had, you know, I had everything else, so I was really fortunate. And hopefully with the loan repayment, they'll be able to pay back most of my loans, which some people have concern for this, but this is through NIH. So there are politics where some people think this is not okay, but I think, you know, we're funded through NIH. We're doing the work of NIH. They have allocated the funds to help support those of us who are really trying to do this work that takes a lot of time and effort and resources. So
you've put in the years to getting really specific high level of training. So I think absolutely apply for the loan repayment program.
Yeah.
That's an excellent way, I think, to help defer some of the pain and cost that's been associated with that.
Well,
level and of the education. Purpose of that program is to help people who otherwise couldn't afford to stay in research because we don't get, you know, paid the big bucks to stay in research. That's the whole point, is that if, you know, they can kind of alleviate that burden, then we can continue to do this work that is so important. So
the postdoc,
what you say, it fits the bill.
Yeah, the postdoc, I did work a little bit. I supplemented with working at the rehab, well, at the hospital, like on campus and the rehab. Well, I guess the whole hospital, actually. But the stipend to live on a postdoc is very minimal. So, you know, you get a stipend, but it's barely enough to live. And actually, I should also mention, my parents have been very, very generous. And when things have gotten tight, they have helped a lot. So I was fortunate to have that.
It is fortunate to have other people to help. But as you mentioned, that the stipend for a PhD, if you are in a program that's funded, and the stipend for a postdoc is not, you're not living in, you know, luxury, particularly if you have other people that you're caring for or a family.
Yeah. Even if you're not caring for anyone, it depends on the city you're living. You know, I was in Los Angeles, and so it's expensive to live there, but well worth it.
I'm going to say, I think, I don't know, I've enjoyed listening to your experience, and I think you made a couple points that to me are really salient, right? Like, everybody's journey is different. It's really important to talk to mentors and those around you who can kind of help guide you, especially at these important decision points. And then just to ask the questions about what's available to you.
And
so
develop your community and reach out. Like, I wouldn't have made it through all of this without developing my OT community, and then also like the researcher scientist community, and then a solid group of friends who were willing to listen and understand. Like, I sorted out a lot of people in my life during these last years, just because you can only be around people who don't get it for so long or in a little bit. So thank you so much, Kelly.
Thanks for joining us today. If you have anything else that, anything else you want to share?
I don't think so. I just looked through my notes actually, and we covered everything.
I think we did too. I added a link for the resources for this to the loan repayment the loan repayment program with NIH, yeah. And then also an article from the Chronicle on Higher Education on who can live on a PhD stipend, because it's not high.
Oh, that's really great. I'm going to read that and give that to all of my PhD students.
It does vary by program, though. So anybody who's listening, make sure that you inquire and ask if they do have a stipend, how much it is, and anything else related to that.
I think I have one more comment, actually.
Sure,
It's about the postdoc, though. I will say, when I got to the postdoc, and this is relevant if you do a postdoc, because you can be paying your student loans if there are any at this mm-hmm. time or not. But when I submitted for the NIH, K99-ROO, I was able to put in a higher salary cap, because we're not just looking at the pay of occupational therapists, physical therapists, rehab professionals, they're also looking at physicians' pay, and they make mm-hmm. more. And so I was able to boost it pretty significantly. But that's without taxes and everything pulled out. But still, nonetheless, it was mm-hmm. much more significant than the postdoc. So I could use some of those funds even to, I mean, that was my my salary. I could use that to pay back loans and stuff.
That's pretty great. I mean, to be able to increase that stipend, that like that postdoc salary a bit. Mine was the NIH minimum.
Well, you know, and I don't even know how it was the mechanism that mattered, because it was a K99-ROO, and definitely where I was conducting the research and that kind of stuff. But we just, you know, my mentor was like, let's put this in, let's max it out and see what happens. And they accepted it. And so it was easier for me as a postdoc to live and do good research, good science.
Thank you for joining us today. Check out our other episodes to hear more. You can find the first season on YouTube under Washington University Program and Occupational Therapies channel under the First Fridays for OT Research playlist.
And more episodes of Demystifying Research linked under the Research tab on the Washington University OT webpage at ot.wustl.edu. That's ot.wustl.edu. Send us your ideas for future episodes at demystifyingresearch@wustl.edu.